I think that all of us have these very deep feelings of tenderness.
You get stronger as you become more open.
If I can be vulnerable, that'll help other people be vulnerable.
And it doesn't work for me to be silent.
I can't believe I'm going to tell you this story, but I'm going to tell you this story.
This is the first time that I've told aloud.
If I could have known that you and I were alike, I would have had so much more hope.
Listening to other people's stories, you realize,
wow, these people are all experiencing the same thing that we are.
You are not the only one.
Welcome to Safe Space Radio's Healthcare Education Podcast on suicide. At the end of this show, please go back to our website to answer a few questions that will help reinforce some of the important clinical takeaways. Your feedback will also help us learn more about the value of hearing our patients as teachers. The rates of suicide are rising. The CDC reports that from 1999 to 2016, there was a 30% increase in deaths by suicide in the United States. This podcast does not speculate about the causes of this increase. Rather, we focus on understanding the nature of suicidal feelings and the impact on both family members and survivors. We begin our discussion of suicide by hearing from Rachel. She discusses her son's chronic battle with depression and repeated suicide attempts. He currently resides in a state mental hospital where he's continued to attempt suicide. His story illustrates some of the risk factors for suicide, the concept of ambiguous loss in families, and the stigma surrounding suicide that touches patients and families alike. Rachel is a family liaison counselor for a major American university. She's the mother of three grown kids. Brad, who suffers from a life-threatening depression and is currently in a state mental hospital. Another son with depression and anxiety. And a daughter who has suffered the fear and sadness of her two brothers' mental illnesses. Rachel is offering this interview anonymously in order to protect the privacy of her children. Welcome to Safe Space, Rachel.
Thank you very much, Anne. It's a pleasure. And I'm so pleased that you're doing this series.
We're going to focus mostly today on Brad's story, although keeping in mind always that we know you have two other kids. So I'd love to start by just asking you to tell me a little bit of who Brad is and the story of what happened to him with his depression.
Sure. Because Brad is, of course, so much more than his depression, and so much more to me, because I remember when he was just the most sunny, solid, secure little guy who just couldn't stop laughing in his early childhood. And he loved cartoons, and he adored his little brother, and he admired his big sister, and he played around the neighborhood and loved superheroes and was always sort of charging around as a superhero with a cape and so forth. And just the most adoring, just loving and lovable little guy. And also an artist, and I know that's a common theme. It's so often art is a double-edged gift. But when he was young, he was very gifted in the arts, and he remained that way and pursued it in school and was considered a promising artist. And in his teens, in his sophomore year, he just suddenly dropped out of school. He was living with his father. We were divorced. And just all of a sudden, he was doing wonderfully in school and had his whole life. He just dropped out and came back to my house and barricaded himself in his room, you could almost say. He only came out for meals and refused to see doctors or counselors or to talk about what was going on, and just went on the internet and kept himself in his little bedroom in my house. I was, of course, terribly worried and was trying a number of different things to help him when one night he knocked on my bedroom door in the middle of the night, and I opened the door, and he sobbed, "I'm so sorry, Mom," and dropped at my feet, unconscious. And I got a phone call, and I had sense to pick it up, and it was an internet friend saying, "I've just talked with Brad. He says he's just taken a whole bunch of pills. He may be in danger." And I said, "Thank you. I'll hung up, called 911, and just held him in my arms, saying, "Please don't go. Please don't go," and waited for the EMTs. That was his his first suicide attempt, and he seemed to get better after that. Not to have it easy, but to get better, and he went on to a prestigious art school with a full scholarship and graduated with highest honors. You know, not that it was easy, but he sometimes stopped for a bit and then went back, but he was doing well, and then afterwards he got a good job. And then in his later 20s, he just crashed and couldn't manage to live in his own place anymore, even though he'd been helping other people in the family and helping his little brother with a place to live and others. Suddenly he just couldn't manage. And he ended up being hospitalized and going into residential treatment and back and forth. And then a year and a half ago, he landed in the hospital again and basically hasn't been out of the hospital since. He was out. He would be out briefly, and then attempt suicide and go back in. And fortunately, one hospital held on to him until he could be put in a long-term hospital setting in a state hospital, where he's been the last year, still attempting suicide. He's attempted suicide 5 times in the hospital, and he is just desperately, desperately depressed.
So all this treatment has not really been able to help him?
It hasn't. A lot of different medications have been tried. They're trying one right now that everyone feels a little more hopeful about, and he's saying that he feels a little better. So we're crossing fingers.
I can imagine.
If it works, it's an extremely powerful drug with lots of pretty heartbreaking side effects. But it beats the alternative.
So ever since that one catastrophic night when he was a teenager, you've really had to live in fear for his life.
I have feared for the phone ringing, you know, and feared for his life, absolutely.
I'm listening to his story. It sounds like it illustrates in some way so powerfully this cyclical nature of depression, you know, that he was terribly ill and then went on to be this extraordinary art student and so on. And then it sounds like he was just hit with it so hard afterward.
Yeah.
And then really has not yet been able to come back to himself.
Right. They told me when he was 17 and had this first breakdown that it put him at risk of another one. But of course, I didn't want to think about that.
No.
But indeed, I gather that each one puts you at higher risk of another one.
Yes. One of the subjects that I want to ask you about is this kind of process of loss for you, that here is this sunny boy, your artistic, you know, as you describe him, I'm just picturing this very beautiful son. And, you know, now he's been in this hospital for a year and a half and so desperate to not be alive. And I'm wondering how you bear that sort of series of losses, and if you might speak to what that process of grief has been like for you.
Well, I thank you for recognizing it, because it is grief, absolutely, both for him and for me. And one of the things he's struggling with now, of course, as time goes on, he really has more and more to be depressed about, because he has lost so much. For me, the process is really well described by the phrase ambiguous loss, which is the title of a book and a phrase that that a therapist uses, whose name is Pauline Boss, B-O-S-S. And if you go on the internet, actually, and just Google ambiguous loss, her website turns up. And I was so relieved to find that book and that concept, because it describes that feeling of, you know, you've lost the person. They're still here. They're still alive, but they're not the same person. So you've lost them, but you haven't lost them. And how do you struggle with that? Because it's also an ongoing process. I visit Brad every day in the hospital, and sometimes he's there, and sometimes he's not. Not literally, but sometimes, you know, the old Brad is there, and sometimes he's so either under a cloud from the the weight of the medication, or so tortured by his desperate thoughts that he's not there. He's not the same person that I raised, and he's not the same person that I knew in his 20s, and he's not the same person he knew. So it's a constant struggle, and frankly, I don't know what I'd do without good therapy. To be honest, I don't know how I would have gotten through last winter, for example, when he first got to this long-term hospital without a good therapist, just to help me sort that all through, and also to be a place to grieve where it was understood what I meant.
As I listen to you, the parallel that comes to me is what I hear from so many people about what it's like to go visit an aging parent with dementia in a nursing home.
Exactly.
And kind of the driving, making themselves go because they really believe in that and want to be there, but coming home, driving home in tears every time. Because
yeah.
Either the parent was, you could feel their essence still present and other times not, and it sounds so similar.
Yes. And Pauline Boss talks about a number of examples, but those are exactly two of them. Complicated in Brad's case because, we don't know. I know with a dementia, sometimes a person comes out from under the cloud and then goes back. And with Brad, we don't know how much he's lost permanently and how much he's lost temporarily. We know it's some of both, and he knows it's some of both.
Right, so you're not even sure what to hope for.
Exactly, yeah.
I can imagine feeling afraid to hope.
It's hard for him to hope and for us to hope. It almost makes more sense, just to live the wonderful wisdom of one day at a time, just not thinking about the future, but just, if it's a good day today, thank you.
Right.
And if it's not, well, there's tomorrow.
So I want to ask you now a little bit about your experience as a mother. We live in a culture where mothers get blamed for almost everything that their kids struggle with.
Yes.
Or, we blame ourselves. And
yes.
I'd like to ask you a little bit about how that has been for you, whether you have struggled with all the ways that you question, did I do this wrong, or would this made a difference, or how much has that been a struggle for you? In feeling ashamed that your son struggles so much with this illness?
It's one of the toughest things of all. There isn't a day that goes by that I don't have a moment when I say, oh, well, maybe if I'd done this differently, maybe if I'd done that differently. And it doesn't help that there is still, there's been a lot of improvement, but there's still a lot of blaming of families. So when you go to visit in the hospital, you're under suspicion. You're being watched. Are you a bad influence? Are you kind of at best a neutral influence? And usually when there's a family meeting, it's kind of about kind of getting the history to try to dig out what the family did wrong. and it's hard. It's hard to fight those thoughts, because they're being reinforced to some extent. But I'm perfectly capable of doing it all by myself, because it's so hard to accept that something so awful could happen to someone so beautiful. You're looking for some explanation, and sometimes it feels as if any explanation, even that's being your fault, is better than there being no explanation and his just having been struck out of the blue.
I want to ask you now more about suicide and about your experience of his attempts as a parent. One of the other people I've interviewed in this series has spoken about living with a mentally ill family member as a form of relational trauma.
Mm.
And just hearing you tell the story earlier about him saying, I'm sorry, Mom, and just dropping unconscious at your feet. I mean, I could feel my whole body starting to tickle with goosebumps, imagining your terror in that moment, and then finding out there have been subsequent attempts. And I guess I'd like to ask you, does it feel like that was a traumatic moment for you, and what has helped you bear this kind of recurrent sense of trauma?
Well, I'm so glad that you are using the word trauma, because I think that too is kind of under-recognized as part of the experience. It is absolutely trauma. I have no question, because I experienced other kinds of trauma as a child that are sort of the classic kinds, and there's no difference. This is trauma, no question. When I think about that experience of Brad dropping at my feet, it has that same sort of searing quality. It's sort of etched in your mind in a different kind of way than most memories are. And then with each succeeding time that he has attempted suicide, of course there has been a re-traumatization. So I have a similar sort of searing feeling about walking into the hospital a couple of years ago after I'd learned that he had attempted suicide, and he'd actually driven himself to the hospital after overdosing, arrived just in the nick of time to collapse and be taken into the emergency room, and I tore out to see him and found him in an ICU in restraints. And yes, they still do that with people that they're afraid are going to run away or going to hurt themselves or hurt someone else. They still tie them down. And so that is seared in my mind in the same way. We're walking into the Date hospital he's in now and seeing just how squalid it was and how just dingy and how, you know, and just how, what horrible conditions, physical conditions, that it made my knees buckle. So yes, there's no question. And even sometimes when he'll just say to me, you know, Mom, I really would be better off dead, because I know it would be better off for you. I know I should have died, and that I feel so awful that I didn't do that for the family, because everyone would be better off if I were dead. You know, just hearing those words, it's just cha-ching. it just goes into a place in your heart that is, it's trauma.
And of course, it's so sad, because almost everyone I've worked with who is suicidal has that belief, genuinely. Yeah. That people would be better off, and it's almost an act of generosity in the strangest possible way.
Yeah.
Or at least perceived that way. And it's so hard to convince someone that is the farthest thing from the truth.
Right.
Yeah.
Again, you know, I think what helps is being as places where you can tell your story, and having people that it's safe to tell your story to, and where you're not worried about where you feel as if they'll be okay if they hear these really hard things.
I see. So sometimes you worry that it will actually hurt the listener to hear it.
Yeah.
That it's so painful. And so when you say that, are you referring to Nami, or are you referring to other friendships where you feel like you can really safely?
Yeah, some of both, particularly Nami, because particularly people who have been through it, so they get it. Yeah.
So what Nami has given you, it sounds like, is a place to be yourself, to tell your story without censoring it, without feeling you have to protect the listener.
Right.
Where you can sort of not compartmentalize all of who you are.
Right.
Do they also give you, I mean, is it a place where you can also kind of brainstorm effective ways to interact with the team, or?
Absolutely. Yeah. Resources, strategies,
yeah.
You know, names of good doctors and lawyers but also strategies for talking with doctors. Absolutely. Yeah.
So the last thing I want to ask you before we're going to have to stop is you describe walking into the state hospital and seeing it, how squalid it is, which is very profound, because people of course end up living there for a long stretch at a time. And I'm curious to ask you about, now that you've been exposed to so much of the mental health system, how you know, what your feelings are about how we as a society invest in the care of people who suffer from such illnesses. And
well, I think partly because we don't feel as if we feel helpless, we feel as if there's not much you can do, they're terribly under-resourced. the staff and the programs in the hospitals profoundly under-resourced. And I think the irony is that with good resources, people can get better. But we actually create a self-fulfilling prophecy that it's hopeless, because by not providing the resources that would make it better.
And when you say that, with resources we could make it better, what are you talking about?
Well, they're beginning to build hospitals that are compassionate and respectful, and where the staff are trained to be respectful. I mean, often the staff are shaming, because that's kind of our whole approach to mental illness at this point, because they haven't been trained that if you're respectful, if you're supportive, if you're positive, that can make a difference. And you also convey that just in the physical surroundings. If you provide, you know, rooms where the windows don't leak rain in during a hurricane, enough blankets, and there's some privacy, that it's like any other illness. You provide good facilities. This changes the message for both the caregivers and the patients.
I see. So even almost the aesthetics of the structure itself can convey the sense of hopelessness and helplessness.
Yes, yes.
We turn now to child psychiatrist Nancy Rappaport, who lost her own mother to suicide when Nancy was just 4 years old. Nancy describes the way her family dealt with this tragedy and shares her own process of detective work as she tried to uncover more about who her mother was and about her eventual death. She offers an example of how survivors struggle to make sense of this tragedy, and especially the legacy of self-blame, even in children. She discusses how this experience has affected her own work as a psychiatrist and the way she thinks about suicide risk in her patients.
Welcome to Safe Space, Nancy.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
You know, I'm just thinking about the forces that contribute to silence in a family about a suicide. And I'm so glad you said, you know, this is not just particular to your family, but it's true of suicide generally. There's this sense of shame and contagion that goes along with it. And I was curious, you know, when you said, what does it mean about me? You know, you were four. As an adult, we imagine that the four-year-old couldn't possibly blame themselves for not somehow being able to save her. And yet, you know, kids have so many different beliefs of their own, and I wonder how much that was part of your struggle.
What you're highlighting is so important, because I know when I was talking with my dad and he was looking at my story, he was shocked, because he had said something to me that really was said in a way as an effort to give an explanation to me, where he had said that, you know, your mother was never the same after you were born. He didn't realize that I took away from that if I hadn't been born, my mother would be alive. He was shocked at that. And what that says is that with families, it's so important to have open communication and have opportunities to be able to revisit an explanation, so that it's not like when you talk about sex, you do it once and you never talk about it again, but that there's, you know, that it may be at the very beginning that you have a young child who doesn't really quite get what suicide is, but you always want to be as straightforward as you can in terms of saying that, you know, your parent killed themselves. They might have been struggling with depression, and they, you know, they loved you very much, and we love you too, and, you know, that we're all very sad about this. And my sense of why families are silent is also because there's so many different ranges of feelings you have when someone's killed themselves. You can feel angry, you can feel betrayed, you can idolize the person. And trying to figure out how a family kind of digests all these feelings, and certain people in the family can position themselves. So,
right, so if people have different feelings at different times,
yes,
right, it's very hard to be in sync with each other.
Yeah.
Yes, I mean, I think about, you know, the statistics on parents after they lose a child, how hard it is for a marriage to survive. And
sure.
I think just two people grieve so differently, let alone, in your case, such a large brood.
And it gets also where you can get very judgmental about how one person, you know, grieves. I mean, there's some researchers who will say repression is a really good thing. and just bottle it up. And other people who would say, you know, the fact that you can talk about it openly, you know, somehow, you know, elevates you on the hierarchy of grief. And I really have come to a profound acceptance that we all have different paces of grieving and feelings towards the person who suicided, and we have to have a certain level of tolerance about that. Compassion.
Yes, that feels so important. I want to shift now to talking a little bit more about your mom. The story begins with a description of her childhood as you've tried to piece it together, obviously not having been there. I found it particularly poignant that she had lost a sibling, interestingly enough, when the sibling was four, as I understood it, and that in her mother's grief, your grandmother, that she may have felt sort of, oh, if it hadn't, you know, if only it had been you instead of the sister, and just the devastation of it, the loss of a child and a family. I wondered if you could speak about the legacy of that and how you understood the impact of that on your mother.
Again, I felt as though I was writing this memoir, it was like Detective Nancy, because I didn't have any knowledge about, I knew there was something around that my mother's sister had died, but we weren't clear what had happened. It was something that my sister vaguely remembered. And I was interviewing a man who had been a confidant of my grandmother, and he told me the town and what he thought was the year that this had happened. And that's what allowed me to get a newspaper article that described my, at the time, four-year-old aunt and my 8-year-old mother, and the fact that they had just moved into house 9 days before, and the 4-year-old, Judy was her name, had gone to walk out into the new property and had drowned in a pond and was found after my grandmother came home. And so here was my mother. I don't know. Did she witness it? Did she not witness it? What kind of guilt did she follow? What kind of feeling did she have that then she was going to have 6 children and have a brood that was going to surround her, and then she's in a custody battle where she may lose her kids? And it had a quality of peeling back the onion to get to some, you know, core understanding, even though it was very elusive, about my mother.
In my training, also as a psychiatrist, I remember one of my teachers saying to me, if you're working with a very suicidal patient, a useful and relatively often unasked question is there anyone who wants you dead?
That's a good question.
I've never forgotten that. It was so powerful, and I was struck in reading your book, you know, that at one time, imagining that maybe her mother might have felt like, oh, if it had, you know, if only it had been you and not the other sister, and wondering how much that had burdened your mother.
That's what I wanted to do with the reader, though. I wanted to have...
You did it.
I wanted to have you be, you know, Detective Anne.
I was.
And have us looking together, so that sometimes it's not me standing up and saying, this is my opinion about it. I'm sort of placing the facts, lining them up as best as I can, and then saying, well, what do we think about this? Because when you start the book, it's very polarized. You have these newspaper articles that really make it sound like my mom was sort of competent but high-strung, flamboyant, left the kids. My dad's, you know, coming in being somewhat of a savior, but then you have the pictures after which make it sound like my mom is this bereft mother that was, you know, destroyed by the power of my father. And what I want as I'm going along is to say this is very nuanced and complicated. Not to burden the reader, but to not oversimplify. And the other aspect is I wanted a really clear message, because when you talk about being a psychiatrist, when I work with suicidal patients, what I feel is the most toxic is that they believe they're expendable. And they truly believe, if I'm not here, no one's really going to miss me. And that's lethal, because the reality is there are 33,000 suicides that happen in this country, and that leaves over 250,000 people devastated. And I really wanted to be able to get the reader to care about my mother and then understand the tragedy.
You describe so effectively this passage in the novel that she wrote, where she describes the main character who suicides having a successful wake and everyone else sort of continuing on just fine, and how much that showed you the distortion in her thinking about, you know, how people would be unaffected.
I was so mad at her when I read that. Even though it was the character saying it, I thought, you know, here there's 40 pages after the main character kills himself, and the son is sitting around, you know, arranging flowers at his mother's wedding. And I'm like, you are so clueless. That is so far from the truth.
Yes, and it paves the way. Paves the way. I want to shift then now to the discussion about impulsivity.
I just want to make sure I don't sound too mean to my mom. I didn't mean that like she's clueless. You know, I just meant that's a faulty logic to think that no one's really going to care and we're all going to be arranging flowers.
That's how I heard it. That's exactly how I heard it. So I want to ask you more about impulsivity, because there also is this tension for the reader. Sort of following you, was this an impulsive suicide or was it premeditated? And you have this very powerful sort of reflection on the deadly role of impulsivity with suicide and how being impulsive is even more dangerous than hopeless. And I wondered if you could say more about that.
That was a profound recognition for me as a clinician, and it's shifted how I evaluate suicidal patients, because what became clear not only in the research I did about my mother, but also in preparing the book and wanting to be well-versed and using it as a learning tool around suicide, that sometimes it's not around the severity of depression as much as it is the combination of mental illness, impulsivity, and substance abuse and hopelessness. It's that lethal combination. So in impulsivity, that's that split second that the patient puts their foot on the accelerator and ends up being in a tree or puts a noose around their neck, and that's why if you're depressed and you end up drinking a lot of alcohol, that's so dangerous, because if you are someone who does things recklessly and you combine it with depression. So I looked at the quality of some of the decisions that my mom made in terms of decisions, you know, leaving my dad with six kids and ending up being with a man that was 10 years younger than her, that those kinds of decisions were combined with a sense of hopelessness really worrisome.
Yeah, so you were looking for clues that she could be impulsive mm-hmm. in other ways. And yet she writes this novel all about the main character who seems so much like herself, where she commits suicide. Which makes it sound so premeditated.
That's true. And where again, she's dead, so I don't know what the answer is. I'm just circulating around, just as you have so thoughtfully been doing with me during this interview. My understanding of that was she had made a suicide attempt 2 years before she did a completed suicide, which is common with people who do completed suicides, that they've made an attempt before, which is why it's so important for folks to get treatment after a suicide attempt. And I thought of it as that she was trying to make some sense of what that suicide attempt had meant. But again, I don't know, because I didn't get a chance to ask her, why did you have your main character, you know, die by suicide? And was it to try to kind of work through a suicide attempt you'd meant, or pave the way to a completed suicide?
Right, so that's one of those unanswered questions.
Mm-hmm.
It's important and humbling to note that despite increasing rates and awareness of suicide, we are limited when it comes to our ability to accurately predict suicide risk. In a 2016 study from Australia, researchers found that 95% of high-risk patients will not attempt suicide, and over 50% of all suicides are likely to occur in patients who were deemed, quote, lower risk by clinicians. As suicide rates continue to rise, it becomes increasingly imperative that we learn more about prevention. Both Rachel and Nancy highlight something important that we do know about suicide, that a previous suicide attempt is the strongest risk factor for future completed suicides. Our next guest, Sherry Huber, survived her own near-lethal attempt and was greatly assisted in her recovery by the practice of Zen meditation.
She's the author of 20 books. In fact, her 20th book is coming out in the fall.
But in terms of our discussion tonight, she's the author of the Depression book and the book There Is Nothing Wrong With You. Sherry, welcome to Safe Space.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you.
I wondered if we could start by having you tell me the story of what led you to that desperate point in your life.
Yeah. Of course, one of the difficulties in looking back on an event like that is that my life is so different now. It's really sometimes difficult to put myself back in the place of that, even though I was 26, I think it was at the time, very young person, struggling in life circumstances that were really felt beyond her. Mm-hmm. And going to various places, attempting in a fairly significant state of unconsciousness, as one is. You know, I mean, the whole world, I think, would agree that it's a state of mental illness that a person is in when they're going to put a gun to their own body, try to kill themselves. It didn't necessarily feel like mental illness, of course. It just felt like I didn't know what to do next. I tried to get professional help, and nothing really worked for me, and I just didn't know what to do. I just knew that when I looked ahead, I could not face literally another day of being as miserable as I was right then.
Mm. And so then tell me, you know, one of the important things in the media reporting about suicide is I don't want to glorify it in any way, but maybe you can just tell us what you did and what happened afterward.
Oh, yeah. I'm a country kid, so guns were very familiar to me, and that was what I chose to use, primarily because, again, in that same state, I didn't know what else to do. It's not like I had access to any kind of medication or, you know, that sort of thing. So I just got a rifle and put it in my stomach and pulled the trigger. And when that happened, you know, there's such a shift from this is a good idea, I just won't be here, to oh my God, I didn't know pain could be that intense. So then 911 came to, because I was, you know, I was not alone at the time. I was in an apartment building, and, you know, I woke up 2 weeks later in a hospital, just, you know, bandaged and restrained, and with, I find out later, a sign on the outside of my locked door that indicated that I was a suicidal mental patient and needed to be watched very carefully.
You write, you tell of a very powerful conversation or really monologue that you had with your surgeon. I wondered if you could tell that story.
Yeah. It's one of my favorite memories, actually, because it's very disorienting to do something like that, you know, to do something so, I don't use the word dramatic in a, you know, a sort of a disparaging way, but I mean, it's a pretty big thing.
Yep.
To do, and to know that you're going to die, and then to wake up alive, and I remember being very, very disoriented, and in through the door comes this chap, and this was a long time ago, so he actually had a cigarette hanging out of his mouth with this great long ash growing on it as he's mm-hmm. talking to me, and he walks up to the side of my bed, and he looks down at me and he says, nobody should be able to live, nobody should live through what you have just lived through. I would suggest that you find out what you are here for. And turned on his heel and walked out of the room. And it was just, you know, one of those, you're hysterical and somebody slaps you.
Yes, I was going to say, like a profound wake-up moment.
Exactly. And it truly was a turning point in my life, because I realized as I was there recovering for quite a lot longer, because I really did myself some very profound damage. I thought, you know, I've really tried everything in my life. I've tried everything I knew how to do to be the person that I should be and fit into society and live a good life. And the one thing that I had never, ever, ever considered was happiness.
Okay, so help me understand what you mean, I never considered it. Didn't you long for it and wish for it?
It was always going to be a result of something else. So down the road, when I lived the life I should live, when I was who I should be, when everything came together, then I would be happy. It never occurred to me that happiness could be a focus for life.
And not a byproduct that you had to earn through striving.
Exactly.
So from the surgeon saying to you, I suggest you figure out what you're here for, to realizing that you wanted to make your focus happiness, that's also a relatively long stretch. How did you get from one to the next?
Well, it was actually a pretty fast turnaround, because it occurred to me in that exchange that there must be people who knew what I didn't know. It must be possible to figure out life. So one of my earliest memories when I was early teens or preteen was looking at life, trying to figure it out. I found life to be very cruel, actually, and I couldn't figure out how, given the fact that we do not know where we came from, what we're doing here, we're on this clod of dirt rocketing around in space, and I'm supposed to get an education and find the right person and have children and save money for my retirement, and that's my life program. And it just struck me as impossible. It just seemed crazy.
So, like a kind of a living death almost.
Pardon me?
Like a kind of a living death almost.
Yeah. Yeah. And just, I mean, what is the point? Why, given those unanswered questions, why would anybody want to do those things? Why, why didn't we all just escape to an island somewhere and eat mangoes under a tree and work on our tan? Although, truth be told, I didn't have those thoughts now. But I did then set out to try to figure out, did anybody know how to do this? Was there an alternative to that story that I had been given to live? And so, that plunged me into philosophy. And then when I found out that, they had really good questions too, but didn't seem to have a lot of good answers, I turned to religion. And I wasn't raised with any religion at all. And so it was a really fascinating field of study for me. And what I was looking for was, who can give me a better life purpose than the one that I have currently? And fortunately, blessedly, Zen actually was the very last thing that I explored, going kind of through it alphabetically. And,
very systematic.
Very systematic, yeah. I'm a very organized kind of person. And when I got to that, I realized not that I understood what this guy was talking about, but I knew he knew what I wanted to know. And that's what launched me on the rest of my life.
So let me understand that. When you say, I knew he knew what I wanted to know, what was that? What did
peace.
He know?
He seemed
peaceful.
I knew he was at peace.
And how was it? Is this a speaker you went to, or was this a book? How
no,
could
it was
you
a,
tell?
It was a book I read. It was a book by a chap named D.T. Suzuki, who was one of the first individuals to bring Zen from Japan to the West. And it was this very kind of simple explanation of Zen practice, and it was just obvious to me from the way he communicated that he had found a level of understanding and peace that was what I was longing for, but was never able really to put a name to.
Our next guest, Patricia Ellen, is the mother of a young man who did die from suicide. Patricia describes the events leading up to Doug's death and talks about her own emotional response to this tragedy. According to the CDC, suicide death rates for children 10 to 19 years old rose by 56% between 2007 and 2016. The 2015 Youth Risk Behavior Survey also revealed that high school girls attempt suicide twice as often as boys. However, boys are more likely to use lethal means and die from suicide. While this clip does not include this part of our discussion, it's important to know that just prior to Doug's suicide, he was bullied terribly at school. Both being bullied and bullying others increase a child's risk of suicide-related behaviors.
I feel like you've survived probably what is every parent's ultimate worst nightmare, and I really just want to start by honoring your courage and coming to tell us your story.
Thank you.
So let's begin there. What is the story of what happened with Doug?
Doug was 14. It was September. He had just started in high school. And I came home from a date one night, and the man I was with went outdoors to let his dog out and came back in and said, "Don't go out on the porch." And I said, "What?" And I went out on the porch, of course. And Doug was out there, and he had shot himself with a rifle I had let him buy just a couple weeks earlier. I had told him he could have the rifle as long as he took a hunter safety course because I wanted him to be safe. And he had been good with guns before, and so this was totally unexpected. And you know, I just hindsight, I never would have done it if I had the choice. Doug actually lived for 3 weeks. He was in the hospital, so we did have a chance to be with him. He didn't die from his gunshot wound. Be with him after he had shot himself. And he was aphasic. It had affected his brain, and so he couldn't speak, but he could interact with us in other ways. So we did get to communicate with him some, but not talk about what happened. The hospital encouraged us not to talk about what happened, saying he probably wouldn't remember and we'd have lots of time. And unfortunately, the lots of time part, they were wrong about. He died from a blood clot that went to his heart shortly after I left the hospital 3 weeks later. So that's kind of that's our journey. We'd lost him, thought we saved him, and lost him again.
So you find him on the porch. He's still alive. You get him to medical help. Mm-hmm. And then at some point, you get the advice that you should not talk to him about it. And tell me about that, how you felt about it then, how you feel about that now.
It felt like, again, he was still recovering and he couldn't talk to us. He could just point with the board. So that felt okay to not bring it up. Probably I didn't know how to bring it up even so. And I trusted the medical professionals. So I don't know. It wouldn't have made a difference anyhow. You know,
right.
I think the important thing is that he knew in those 3 weeks that we loved him. I mean, we were all there. We were all supporting him. The school, actually, the kids made a tape that they sent in saying how much they hoped he would get better and so on. So I think he got to know that part.
So you got to give him that love.
Yeah.
Before he died.
Yeah.
I'm so glad.
Oh, I know, it's a blessing that most families don't get, that they have a suicide loss.
So that, did you feel, you know, in retrospect, that that helped you kind of, you live after he had died?
Probably right in, immediately after, no. I was like, it was a real struggle to want to stay alive after he died.
I think
that's something a lot of parents struggle with, and I think the saving grace is my daughter. I was never going to do anything to cause her that much harm. You know, I wouldn't put her through that again. But there's certainly the pain is so great, you really wonder if you can endure it.
Yes, so it was no comfort to you, really.
Time later, you know, as we went on, the moments were comfort, or some of the moments that we shared was some comfort.
Mm-hmm. And did you find yourself angry with the doctors that they had promised you a future that you didn't get to have?
No, because that was like so not down the line. One of the places was I would go home at night and I was angry at Doug for not telling us what he was feeling. And
tell me more about that.
I would go home at night. He had a punching bag in the basement, and I'd go home and slam the punching bag for about 20 minutes and tell him, "Why didn't you talk to me? Why didn't you talk to me? Why didn't you let us know what was going on? We could have helped." And that was enough, once I got that out, that I could go into the tears, which was really the stronger feeling. Mm-hmm. So.
Right. And so was that what you would do? You'd first express the anger and then you'd cry at night?
Yeah.
And then
yeah.
you'd go back to the hospital?
Well,
this is after he died.
No, just when he was in the hospital, was being there with him as much as I could, continuing to, the other advice we got was take a measured pace being at the hospital, because you're going to have to pace yourself for a long time. And so I would also go off to work part of the day.
Right. You were in it for the long haul.
We were in it for the long haul, and there wasn't a long haul.
Mm. So. Yeah, I feel such sadness for you thinking about that. So, you know, one of the things that I wanted to ask you, because I think it's a legacy of suicide for almost anyone who loves someone who dies that way, is kind of the complication of different feelings all at the same time. And you've named anger and tears. Mm-hmm. You know, the one that comes to mind often, I think, is the feeling of guilt or all the what ifs and if onlys. Mm-hmm. And tell me about that for you, about how... I imagine that was an enormous struggle.
It's an enormous piece, yeah. I think as a mother, you always believe you're going to keep your child safe, and that's your job and that's your role. So the guilt that I didn't see something, that I didn't keep him safe, guilt that I was out on a date and not home, you know, wondering, had he been in counseling, would it have made a difference? You know, all of those things. And that was a struggle. That's the weight thing that weighed you down, and the kind of, if only I'd done this, if only I'd done that, would we have had a different outcome? And that's a long process. People say, well, you can't do that. You can't second guess yourself, but you can't not.
Right.
You can't, it's part of the process.
As if you could not do that.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I know it's been 23 years. Do you still do it?
No. No.
So how did that happen?
I think a lot. One is, I hear so many stories. So the if only he was in therapy. And then I heard a story of a family that lost their child right after he left his therapist's office, you know, or the if only I'd been home. And I hear a story of a family that loses their child when he's home with them and just goes upstairs and dies. So what I'm realizing is there's a lot of things you can't do. You can do a lot of things to try to keep your child safe. Like, I wouldn't have guns in my house. I'd recommend to anybody not to have guns in their house. That's just too easy a way. But there's no surefire thing. You can just do your best.
I want to shift now to, you know, you teach about adolescent suicide, and, you know, if you had to say what you think is the most effective prevention, or what you really hope that people can learn from this conversation about suicide in adolescence, what would that be?
I think the one thing I mentioned already is that friends don't keep secrets. I think the other thing, that the meaning of my work at the center, is a lot of what we do is helping kids find safe ways to express feelings. And I think one of the things that I learn more and more about suicide is that sometimes it's this unrelenting pain that feels like there's no way out of, that it's really, somebody doesn't want to die, they just want to stop hurting. And finding people, knowing that there are people who can help, can sit through the emotions with you, be present, I think is one of the biggest things that helps. So for parents to know that, for kids to know, to seek out somebody who can be a support person. And I think part of what we as a culture need to do is to find ways to lessen the shame of somebody being in pain and needing help, and making it okay to reach out.
That feels huge to me. And what are your ideas about how to do that? Because that feels so important.
Well, I think, you know, I think one of the things is we model it as adults, as we talk about our own struggles and our own need to reach out, and if we're adults that people respect and look up to, we are indirectly giving permission for people to do that.
Right, so it's bearing our own pain without shame.
Yeah, yeah. And it's telling our stories. There's a family that's been pretty public that lost their son to suicide, and they have been very public about talking about his journey through depression and trying to get medication and how we need to recognize that depression is something that affects people and get them help and, again, take the stigma away from depression. So, again, it's people being brave enough to tell their stories.
Yes, and while we're talking about telling stories, you have a very interesting point, I know, about language. And I wondered if you could tell me what your feeling is about how we talk about suicide.
I think it's one of the ways of lessening shame and letting people feel free to say, you know what, I'm hurting so much, I wish I could find a way to end my life, to make it stop, is that we need to lessen the shame around suicide. Not that it's something, an act to choose, but that we decriminalize it. Very often people will say somebody committed suicide. And if you think about what commit means, commit either means committing somebody to a mental institution, or commit very often means a crime. And both of those, and that's actually the way people looked at suicide for a long time. And in fact, people who die from suicide die from an illness just like people die from cancer. So we need to start languaging differently. Somebody dies from suicide. Somebody dies from depression. That's different than it's not a crime, and it's somebody's not crazy. Sometimes life gets really hard, and sometimes we're in pain, and it should be okay to reach out for help, just like it'd be okay to reach out to a doctor if I broke my leg.
I often tell people that depression is a life-threatening illness.
It is.
The National Suicide Prevention Lifeline is a network of local crisis centers that provide free and confidential emotional support to people in suicidal crisis or emotional distress, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. If you or someone you know is struggling with depression or suicidal thoughts, please call the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline at 1-800-273-8255. This is an important number to have on your cell phone. Take a note of it. 1-800-273-8255. This concludes this episode of Safe Space Radio's Healthcare Education Podcast on suicide. Please fill out the few quick questions on the website that will give you credit for listening and help to solidify some of the most important clinical takeaways. We'd be grateful, too, for your feedback about this show. Your responses will help us measure the impact of hearing stories from the people who know these struggles from the inside. Thank you to the Josiah Macy Jr. Foundation for their support of this project, our guests, our producers Gabe Graben and Caitlin Swaljay, and our education coordinator, Sarah Powers. I'm Dr. Ann Hallward, and I invite you to check out the rest of our archive devoted to telling authentic and inspiring stories about the things we would struggle with less if we could talk about them more.